Summer at Waitrose is good right now. Here's the perfect excuse for a barbecue. Pick up succulent chimichurri Bavette steaks, spicy harissa halloumi kebabs, and juicy beef and bone marrow smash burgers. Just a selection from our 3 for £12 barbecue range, online or at your local Waitrose. Grab your tongs and turn up the grill. Waitrose. Food to feel good about. Selected lines and stores subject to availability.
All the big names are here. Ooh, who's that?
I think she was in the movie about that really big shark.
No, not her. The florist.
Oh, she's automating invoices on the go so she can spend more time on that flower wall.
QuickBooks can save you up to 8 hours a week so you could bring your vision to life. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks.
How you doing, Met fans? Welcome to another edition of the Terry Collins Show, presented by Tunnel to Towers, supporting America's greatest heroes. Donate just $11 per month by going to t2t.org. That's T, the number 2t.org. I'm John Arezzi, and joining me as always, the former skipper of the New York Mets, analyst for SNY's Baseball Night in New York, Mr. Terry Collins. Terry, welcome back for another week of Mets Talk.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, John. Thanks. It's exciting. And, you know, it's so great that the team's playing better. And I know that I talked to a lot of people that are, you know, Mets fans and are all getting back excited again. I told them this is a marathon, man. It's a long year and anything can happen. So I'm glad they're doing well.
Yeah, I was actually up in New York last week. Got a chance to see one of the Subway Series games. It was electric there. I was up there working with Tunnel to Towers Foundation. We did some promotional announcements with, thanks to Jay Horowitz, with Mike Piazza at Citi Field. And we taped with Joe Torre at the T-Squared Social sports-themed restaurant. So both of those went really well. The founder of Tunnel to Towers was there doing the interviews. Frank Siller, Larry Olson, Peter Haskell from TDT were there. I want to publicly thank Jay Horowitz for helping set that up and Joe Torre's agent, Maury Gottfried, for their help. Amazing few days. And Terry, I'm sure you will agree with me when I say both Joe Torre and Mike Piazza are incredible individuals who have done so much, not only for baseball, but their charity work as well.
Yeah, it's really special. I mean, I've been to Joe's function, Safe at Home, several times. And, you know, what he's done to help people who are in being abusive families is incredible. And Mike is off the charts great. He'll do anything to help anybody, always did, always will. And that's why he's one of the greatest players ever. You know, what he did on the field, you know, people see, but with what he's doing off the field, that's making a huge difference today. And it goes back to the Jackie Robinson statement, you know, or, you know, it's what people remember for what you've done, you know, to make other people's lives better. So, and that's what Mike's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. What a great guy. And just a wonderful individual. Terry, there's a lot of joy in Metsland right now as we enter the first week of July. They just finished one of the best months in franchise history. Arguably one of the hottest teams, if not the hottest team in the major leagues right now. What a turnaround from a team that seemed way different a little over a month ago.
No question. I think, you know, obviously what Carlos did with changing the lineup around a little bit, getting Lindor in the leadoff spot, and, you know, they've moved Brandon Nimmo. He's back hitting second now. But, you know, the guys are starting to swing. J.D. Martinez, player of the month in for the month of June. You know, he's doing whatever they got him to do, and that is produce runs in the middle of that lineup, drive in runs. And even though he's got big power, you'll see how many runs he's driven in with just singles to the right center field. So, yeah, the lineup's dangerous. We all knew that. Alvarez is back, you know, a big part of the ball club behind the plate. And Mark Vientos has really grabbed this opportunity to show everybody he belongs in that lineup and belongs as the third baseman right now of the Mets. So, but as that season wears on, I'm going to tell you, we got to get that pitching straightened out because it's, you know, when it gets late in the summer, you're going to have pitching to finish it off.
Yeah, especially with what's going on with the Mets with their relievers are so overused, overtaxed. The starters aren't going deep in games, except for Severino. But the Mets did go 16-8 in the month of June, second best record in the major leagues under the Astros, who they just lost two games to, and the Astros finished at 17-8. The Mets climbed to one game over 500 this past Friday. Now they're one game below 500, right there in the wild card playoff picture. Two games out of the third and final spot. Terry, the one thing that I wanted to bring up to you before we get to the pitching is the way the team has come together like a family with each other since the turnaround. You've been on teams that have had this type of camaraderie before. Talk to us about the importance of having a team come together like this as almost like a family.
Well, you know, everybody ignores a lot of times, you know, and again, the most important thing is what goes on in the field. But it's that stuff behind the scenes. It's the clubhouse once in a while where these guys actually respect each other, where they support each other, where they're, you know, somebody has a bad night and, you know, five guys come over and pat him on the back. Hey, get him, you know, be ready for tomorrow, instead of like shunning him because he's, you know, he cost you a game or something. And that relationship that those guys are forming in that clubhouse means a ton. When we in 2015, when we got Michael Kadire came over and he and David Wright got together, and that's when the first time we started to hand out the celebratory belt. And David bought this beautiful former, like, looked like a wrestling belt. And every night the team, you know, had a little selection of who the best player was that particular game, and he got the belt to have in his locker. And I'm telling you, you can't believe the excitement it caused. The guys couldn't wait for the game to get over, so they could see the ceremony of who was going to get the belt. So, yeah, that means a lot. That relationship those guys are forming means a lot.
Absolutely. And with all the good things happening for the team right now, we are in the middle of a 10-game suspension of Edwin Diaz for the use of a sticky substance. And the bullpen, as we mentioned, is being taxed because the Mets starters, other than Severino, have not really gone deep into games. I would think, Terry, that the Mets will go shopping for some relief help and maybe even some starting pitching as the trade deadline of July 31st gets closer. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I totally think you're right, John. I mean, they're back in the hunt. I mean, again, they have another 16-8 month. I mean, they're really going to be in the hunt. So, yeah. But they're, you know, the way that pitching's being used today, you know, that bullpen is so important now, so important on every club, not just the Mets. So, yeah, I think they're going to, you know, there's some teams that are in situations where they're ready to move and get some young prospects. Of course, you're talking to a manager, and, you know, I understand the importance of having good young players in your organization for the long-term stuff, but winning's hard in the big leagues. And when you have a chance to win, in my opinion, you should do whatever it takes to grab that opportunity. So, hey, look, go find yourself a couple of relief pitchers that's going to, you know, bring wins to us as the summer wears on.
Yeah, there's a list out there, and there will be some teams selling. It doesn't look like the Mets are going to be one of them now with this turnaround, but we'll see what happens. We do hope that they can get some help in that bullpen, and maybe even if Senga comes back, there's another piece there. Christian Scott might be brought back as well. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to watch all of this as it unfolds, but they certainly need some relief for that relief core. Terry, the Mets organization and all of baseball – lost the great Willie Mays at the age of 93 on June the 18th. The Mets paid a fitting tribute to Willie before the Subway Series game last Tuesday. What are your memories of the great Willie Mays?
Well, again, you know, John, I'm old enough to had the ability to watch Willie. I didn't get too much because he was on the West Coast most of that time. And, you know, before you had all these games being televised, you know, you had to be living in San Francisco to see many of the Giants games. But, you know, my history of getting to know my time with the Dodgers, you know, because that huge rivalry with the Dodgers and Giants, you know, I used to talk to a lot of the guys, Koufax, John Drysdale, you know, Willie, Maury Wills, all those guys. And I used to ask about who they thought the best player was in baseball. And I'm telling you, to the man, it was Willie Mays. To every guy, it was Willie Mays. And so when you're respected like that from your peers, plus your opponents, that speaks volumes for me. So I'm saddened to hear it, but you know what? He meant a lot to the game. He meant a lot to the black players in the game today. I know those guys that ever got to meet him loved him. So, you know, I'm saddened that he was gone, but we were lucky enough to have him around for a long time.
Yes, we certainly were. And him finishing the career with the Mets was also very, very cool to see him come back. And everyone's going to miss Willie Mays, the Say Hey Kid. Terry, we'll take a look at this week in Mets history. June 27th, 1962, the Mets signed 17-year-old Eddie Cranepool, who had just graduated from James Monroe High School in the Bronx. Cranepool made his major league debut for New York that September. In the Mets' first season and remained with the team his entire 18-year career, retiring at the end of the 1979 season. His 1,853 games in a Mets uniform still lead the team all-time, and he remains in the top five all-time for hits, at-bats, doubles, and RBIs. On June 27, 2008, Carlos Delgado sets a franchise record with 9 RBIs in a single game during game one of a doubleheader against the Yankees in the Bronx. Delgado's big day included a 2-run double, 3-run homer, and a grand slam against the Bronx Bombers. Terry, the first Mets, the Mets swept the first Subway Series last week. We got a few more games to go at Yankee Stadium later in the month. What do you remember most about the Subway Series? Well, you were manager of the Mets. We know the atmosphere of the ballpark is always electric. Was the energy different in the clubhouse for these games against the Yankees when you managed?
Well, yeah, you know, John, I've told a lot of people, you know, when we played the Yankees, it was like a playoff game. It was like a World Series game. You know, there were more reporters. There were more TV stations. There were more, you know, people on the field. You go have breakfast, and people were talking. People were excited. So, yeah, it was a whole different atmosphere when you had the Subway Series. And I remember one time at a World Series game, I told somebody, I said, you know, they're saying, well, this is, you know, a media, this is a big thing with the media, and you're going to see all these cameras. I said, all right, I'm part of the Subway Series. I'm not going to see any more cameras than I did at the Subway Series. So it certainly is a different vibe.
It certainly lights the city up for sure. And finally, Terry, June 28th, 2015, Long Island native Steven Matz allows 2 runs in 7 2/3 innings and records 3 hits at the plate against the Reds at Citi Field. Matz became the first pitcher in the league's history to drive in 4 runs in his Major League Baseball debut. Terry, you were there. Talk to us about Steven Matz's debut, the reaction among the crowd, including that famous broadcast cut to Matz's grandfather, who was passionately cheering on his grandson.
Yeah, it was a tremendous night. You know, if you remember, John, the first leadoff hitter of the game, Phillips hit a homer off Steven Matz. And, you know, the first guy he faced. So, you know, you're thinking, okay, wow. But now I'm telling you what, you're talking about a guy that had plus stuff, threw it for strikes, athletic like crazy on the mound, held runners. And then what he did at home plate was incredible. And in the minor leagues, you know, you had the DH that, you know, pitchers didn't hit till they got to the big league. So nobody had any idea this guy could swing the bat the way he was capable of. So it was a tremendous debut for a great kid.
It certainly was. We remember that. That was so electric in that ballpark that day as well. No place like Citi Field when something special happens, for sure. You can check out Mets history every day by going to @NewYork NYM History on X. And now it's time for this week's Talkin' with TC. Today on Talkin' with TC, we have not one, but 2 former Mets pitchers, still both remembered to this day as fierce competitors and very entertaining personalities. Both of our guests participated in Mets playoff and World Series teams, one during the 1986 championship team and the other during the 2000 Subway World Series. We're very happy to bring on to Talkin' with TC, Roger McDowell and Turk Wendell. Gentlemen, welcome to the Terry Collins Show.
Very nice to be here. Thank you.
Yes, pleasure. Very much pleasure to be here.
Well, I appreciate you guys coming on. You know, we had a great time last week at that golf tournament. I thought, you know, with what's going on with the state of pitching today in the big leagues, you know, I got two relievers here who, you know, been noted for getting ready and pitching in tons of baseball games. And, you know, and I think I would lead off by thinking, you know, what's happened this past weekend, I looked through a lot of box scores, and you know, every team's using four and five relievers every single night due to the fact that starting pitching's not getting deep into a game. Can this possibly be sustainable? Can these relievers, who these guys, and I know you guys were, you know, maybe different types of pitchers, but you know, you guys pitch in 80, 70 games almost every year. And you know, I know it's different when you can had to maybe come in and rise, but I know you know, when you came in, you had to go an inning in the third or something. Can these guys possibly sustain this throughout the season?
You know what, TC, I find it very difficult. You know, the most important thing is you're hamstringing the manager with the number of relievers that you have available for certain nights. And, you know, with starting pitching, obviously, within the last probably 5 years, the depth that they get into games, you know, has become very minimal. So now you're counting on bullpen innings. And I remember as a pitching coach, you know, the one thing you count on is right around 1,000 innings from your starters. And, you know, over the course of the year, you're looking at 1,400, 1,500 innings. So the bulk of that was gotten by the starters. And now your relievers make up for the rest of it. But, you know, I think it's hamstringing the managers. I think it's something that on a nightly basis, it's very difficult to, I guess, to go or prepare for a game or plan for a game. And how do I get through, you know, 4 to 5 innings with relievers that I've used, you know, multiple times over the course of a week. And so it's, I don't know if it's sustainable. You know, obviously 80s was a lot different. My first staff, we had 10 pitchers on our pitching staff, and all the relievers were, you know, you had a couple swing guys, and most of all the relievers were pitching multiple innings. And so, I think it's gotten away from that. I think the rule with the number of pitchers that are hitters you have to face with three hitters at minimum you have to face now may help a little bit, but I don't know if it's very sustainable, TC.
What do you think, Turk?
I think it's going to come down to every team's going to have three guys scheduled to pitch three innings every night. And if they don't go their three, then they'll maybe throw some relievers in there. But I don't think it's sustainable at all. As I joked around before, I mean, this is now the era of Colorado Rockies baseball. The Rockies bullpens were just overly abused because none of the pitchers, I mean, rarely did they ever go 5 or 6 innings. They're always, you know, beat up and knocked out of the game early, and it taxied the bullpen every single night, day in and day out. And like I said to you before, a buddy of mine, Colonel Suskanek, he ended up having shoulder surgery and elbow surgery one off season. So these guys are just getting kind of used and abused. And it's just the, you know, like the barber says next, they just call someone up from AAA to try to fill in. And these guys are just, you know, they're just hurt and over abused by the All-Star break. And it's, there's no way, in my opinion, that it's sustainable for a whole 162 game season and playoffs as well.
You know, I really thought when they passed the new rule about the number of pitchers, limit the number of pitchers you have, I thought it really is going to cause some issues. It's going to really cause health issues because, you know, again, most of these relievers today, everybody wants to come in throwing 95 plus. And so, you know, and when we talked, when we were at that golf tournament, you know, the three of us talked about, hey, it's, you know, it's one thing about getting in the game. It's the other thing about how many times you guys had to get up, you know, during a certain time. And, you know, those are the things the fans don't understand is that, you know, you might get up 2 or 3 times in the game and then finally get in the game. Well, heck, you've already thrown 50, 60 bullets down in the bullpen. Rods, how did you, when you warmed up, did you know you were getting in the game? Did you like, hey, look, I got to save a little bit because I have some warm-ups on the mound? I mean, what was your mental thought process when you were getting ready to go in?
It was a learned process, TC. I tell you what, you know, my first year, I had been a starter my entire minor league career and college career. And come to big leagues, I broke with the team as a middle reliever. And I had to learn the process. I obviously had some great help with guys in our bullpen, Bruce Berenny and Eddie Lynch, who kind of took me under their wing and show me a little bit how to prepare. You know, if you get up, don't get all the way ready. Don't get hot. And use the 8 pitches that you have when you get to the mound to really finalize the preparation. And so I remember one time I was in the bullpen and I was throwing, and Davey Johnson called down to our bullpen coach, Vern Hoschite, at the time, and asked if I was ready. And Vern replied, yes. And Davey said, well, tell him to hold the ball, quit throwing. And so I learned over the course of my career, especially, you know, as years went by, how to prepare the pregame throwing, which, you know, as a pitching coach with the Braves and the Orioles, you see these relievers that go out and they throw 4 or 4:30 in the afternoon. And like you said, TC, they'll throw 100 pitches getting ready at 4:30 in the afternoon. Next thing you know, they're not in the game until 8:30 or 9 o'clock at night, and they got to repeat that process. Just, I guess, from a mental standpoint, from the state safety net standpoint, that they're ready to go in the game. I guess I learned the fact that whatever I had that day was what I had that day. It was not always going to be my top stuff, which really wasn't top stuff anyway. But I knew. I mean, I had two pitches. I had a sinker and a slider. And so all I did was prepare those two pitches. And there were some nights the sinker was, sinking pretty good and the slider was okay. And other nights, vice versa. But, I went out there with the thought that I'm going to pitch in 70 games over the course of the season. I need to save as many bullets as I can. And so when I got up to go and come into a game, I kind of prepared myself that way, knowing that I did have those extra 8 on the mound and I could really finalize my preparation.
Turk?
Like Roger, I was a starter all through the minor leagues. And when I got to I ran out of options where the Cubs couldn't send me down back and forth to be that insurance guy for when someone went down. It was definitely a learning process on how to prepare myself mentally and physically and have my routine, figure out a new routine. I had a routine as a starter, and now I got to figure out a routine as a reliever, and not just a reliever, but a long guy. Cause most of the time long guys, I mean, when you come in the game, the guys have already got 2 or 3 hits. They're thinking they're going to have a career day. So they're super comfortable. And I just joke around when I got established in the big leagues, telling the younger guys that were the long men in the bullpen, the best thing you can do is drill the first guy and say, this shit's stopping right now. But, the way the game's changed, I think maybe in the late 90s, early 2000s, I came to the realization that the teams with the best bullpens are the teams that go deep in the playoffs and win the World Series, because guys just don't go. If you have guys that can go, if you have 3 starters, horses that can go deep into ball games, and you have a really good bullpen, that's just the recipe for success in my book.
Yeah, and I agree. And obviously the game has changed a lot to where, there's no more the matchup that we, that we used to use all the time. I mean, I had, Jerry Blevins, who was my left-handed specialist. And, I think Jerry, I think he pitched in 75 games, but I don't know if he had 75 innings total.
Yeah, there's no strategy anymore.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I mean, he had to get one guy out. But now you've got to face 3 guys. And so I'm saying, gosh, every night these guys go in there, they got to pitch an inning. Instead of, hey, just get us – now, I know, realize if you get out of an inning, they can make a pitching change. But I always thought that was something. And it always bothered me when, the pitching coaches would come in before a game. We had a meeting every night. Hey, who's available? Who's not? And they'd say, hey, so-and-so is not available tonight. And like Roger said, I'd walk outside, and he's playing catch at 150 feet. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. If I can't use him in the game, why is he throwing 150 feet out here? But it's become a routine with these guys where they think they have to throw every single day, and some type place along the line, your arm's got to take a break. Am I wrong?
No, 100%.
You guys are both. I mean, you guys threw a lot of baseballs around. And did you guys do that pregame 15-20 minute throwing program?
I would get loose, but I wouldn't overdo it.
Well, my preparation pregame was. I got 2 things accomplished when I did pregame is during batting practice. And I shagged for my conditioning. Jesse Orozco and I would, we take different right field and left field or vice versa. And we got our conditioning by shagging fly balls. And then because of the distance when you catch the ball or wherever you're at in the outfield and you throw the ball into the kid on the bucket behind second base, that was my throwing. And that was, I never went out and played flat ground. The only really throwing I did before batting practice was just getting loose. And I would extend that distance by shagging and throwing into that guy behind second base. But that was all I did. And the thing was, is, you know, that was to get the blood flowing and get things loose so that if I did come in the game, I was ready 5 hours later. But the other thing is that if I didn't get in the game, how many pitches and how many throws did I save? And, you know, like you said, TC and Turk, being us being in as relievers and being in 70 plus games a season, those throws add up. And so, you know, when you look at a season and you know, you cut it down into thirds, that last third, those last 30 days plus are really, really difficult because guys, and especially now because the expansion of playoffs, you know, you're trying to get in the playoffs, and those last 30 days are different. And the hitters, they don't give at-bats away because it's at the end of the season. They're trying to get to the playoffs. They're trying to get their team to the playoffs. They're trying to go a little bit further. And so I wanted to have as many bullets as I could saved up for the end of the season, those last 30 days, and hopefully go into playoffs and still be ready and have successful pitches when I went out to get people out.
It's interesting that you said about shagging, Raj, because guys don't shag anymore. I joked around, Rod, with I'm brain farting right now, but some of the guys on the team when I was back there in New York a few times, well, nobody's out here shagging. What's going on? Well, if we want to. So that conditioning part of it's done, but they, like you said, they throw, you know, crazy amounts of flat ground work and all that stuff. I remember in spring training not ever once throwing a slider because I was predominantly a slider guy. I said, I'm going to throw enough from during the season. Why do I need to waste them all during spring training?
Right. For?
And TC, you were talking about the left-handers. I used to just chuckle. I mean, a lefty throwing 82 to 85. He got, you know, he's in 74 games, but he pitched 26 innings this year. And I used to laugh going, wow, throwing 80 to 85, I could throw in 162 games if I had to face one guy every night.
Yeah.
Get up and get in.
Yeah, I was on the mound one night when I brought Jerry Blevins in a game and you know, he pitched this guy and I went out, I took him out of the game to bring somebody else because right-handed hitters were coming up. And as Drubal Cabrera was playing shortstop, he says, how much does he make? He goes, he's facing one guy every night, and that's what he's getting paid $5 million.
Yeah.
God.
Oh, you know the other thing, TC, you know, just obviously as we grow older in the tooth, we start to realize a lot of things. And, you know, fortunately I had the opportunity to be a pitching coach in the big leagues, but a lot of times, you know, when you bring relievers in and, you know, you give them the luxury of giving up a run or two because it'll be your offense. And you can cover a little bit more innings if you have confidence in your offense. You know what? And he may give up one, but we're going to score two. Or you look at the other bullpen and say, you know what? If we get in their bullpen, we got them. And so, you know, the things learned from a managerial standpoint of you know, the process that's involved so that you don't, you know, use, you know, 5-6 relievers a light each night. And, you know, when you do have that confidence in your offense, it gets a little bit easier just from a pre-planning part of the game.
Well, you know, Raj, one of the things that I thought really helped when I became the field coordinator with the Dodgers and you were one of the pitching coaches in the organization, Rick Honeycutt was there. You know, one day we were having a discussion, and I'm sure you don't remember this, but you guys brought up the fact that you both of you were starters in the, you know, in the minor leagues, went to the big leagues and pitched out of the bullpens. And I thought, you know, that particular summer, you've got to start training because you don't know which one of these guys in the minor leagues is going to become a relief pitcher. So that's when I said, you know what, sometime this summer, I'm going to take some of our best starting pitchers. Like we did Billingsley and Jonathan Broxton, who became a very good reliever, Hanshi Kuo. And hey, look, you know, this week you guys are going to pitch out of the bullpen so that they could understand with just what you guys said. Hey, my gosh, you had to learn a routine. Well, why not be part of the development process? Because I don't know if you guys have seen many minor league games now, but I mean, they're doing the same thing in the minor leagues. You're starting pitchers in the minor leagues. They're throwing 70 pitches.
Right.
And yeah. So now you've got, you know, you've got, you're using your bullpen every night. Well, that might be a night where one of these times where you start somebody else and bring that, he's only going to throw 40, 50 pitches and bring that other guy back in out of the bullpen. So he learns how to get up and warm up when he gets ready, how to, just what you guys have just been saying. And I think it's, you know, part of the development process is to start training some of these minor league starters to become relievers.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that pretty well, TC. And at the time I had Broxton, and you know, you talked about doing that, and it was a great idea from the standpoint that you start thinking, you know, and I think part of your argument or process was that, you know, kid's hitting third or fourth in the minor leagues, he's not going to hit third or fourth in the big leagues. So let's prepare him. You know, can he bunt? Can he hit and run? Can he do all the other things that may be needed at the big league level if he's hitting seventh or eighth? And so, you know, move that over to the pitching part. And obviously that's one of the big things is that, you know what, you don't know what the kid's going to be when he gets to the big leagues. You know, if he's a starter, great. And hopefully that's something that is valued to the organization. But like Jonathan Broxton, who went on to have a really, really good career as a closer and as a reliever. So, you know, I think by you doing that helped him down the line. And sometimes they don't understand that.
Yeah. So Turk, when you got to the big leagues, you'd been a starter your whole career. Did you find relieving enjoyable? Was it just something you had to do because that's what they called upon you to do?
It was enjoyable once I figured out kind of my niche and my routine, because I'm kind of a hyper, kind of high energy guy, and sitting down in the bullpen and not getting to pitch. And my stuff, my fastball would move and sometimes uncontrollably. I told you the funny story about not pitching for 18 days in 98 when I first came over. Because I got to the big leagues, started a few starts, then ran out of options. So now I'm a long guy in the bullpen. And the next year I go to being a setup guy. And then we signed Mel Rojas. All right. Then I got to be a closer because Doug Jones, they signed him and he didn't pan out and they threw me out there. We had a young kid, Terry Adams, who got called up later in the year, who was the closer of the future for the Cubs at the time. And then they turned around that offseason and signed Mel Rojas. And they said, don't you feel like that's a slap in the face to you? You just saved 18 out of 21 games. I said, I was just somebody they threw out there and it worked. And, you know, Terry's the closer of the future. It's more of a slap in the face to him. So anyway, that the next spring in 97, Riggleman said, hey, I want you to be in the rotation. So I started the entire spring training in 97. The very last day of spring training, Riggs calls me aside and says, look, I just love having you in the pen. If anything happens, you're the first guy in the rotation. Well, his hands were kind of tied and that never happened. So then I go back to being a setup guy. And we get traded to me and Rojas and Brian McCray get traded over to the Mets, and they had Franco and McMichael. And so I go from being a setup guy closer to now I'm back to being a long reliever again. And so long story longer, I told you guys about pitching or not pitching for 18 days. And I go out in a game in Montreal. I mean, my fastball is a wiffle ball. I can't control it. And then Abadaka came to me and said, out to the mound, just said, hey, I'm here to give you a breather. I don't know what to tell you or how to help you. I'm like, well, what the hell? So after that, I kind of figured out my own routine of I had actually tired myself out because I always had way too much energy. I had routes in every city. I ran 5 to 8 miles every day before ball games. And I remember being in Toronto. I get done with my run. And Steve Phillips pulls me aside and he says, hey, don't you think you're doing too much? I looked at him, started laughing. I go, what? Usually you're kicking guys in the ass. They got to do more. I said, Steve, I know my body. I know what I need to do to prepare for tonight. And our strength guy, Barry, he would walk around and make sure every guy, you know, did you do your conditioning today? Did you take care of it? He never had to ask me. If I didn't run today, it's because I knew my body needed a day off. And I think it's hard for some guys to really stay in touch and get in touch with their body and to know what they need to do every single day, mentally, physically, nutritionally, to prepare every single night. And that was my thing.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what our nutrition was going into Chicago was that McDonald's across the street.
Yeah, that was our breakfast.
I couldn't wait for batting practice to be over because there's two bags of quarter pounders with cheese waiting for us. That was nutritious.
Yeah, TC, you can't do that today, Raj. Not today.
I liked relieving as opposed to starting. Well, I only had two pitches, but I liked because I was now I'm an everyday player. And, you know, growing up, you played different positions and you pitched. And so I got to the big leagues and I'm a reliever. And now I can be in five games a week. And I enjoy going to the ballpark knowing that I might get an opportunity to play that day. And that's why I loved it so much is, you know, like Turk, you know, a lot of energy. And but it was fun. It was fun knowing that you're going to the ballpark and you're kind of an everyday player.
Yeah, I like that too, especially being like a closer or a setup guy, because I just thought, you know, if you don't want to pitch when the game's on the line and exciting, why are you out here? But being a setup guy was way different than being a closer, because usually you're coming in when the shit's hitting the fan, there's guys on base, and you do your job, and then you turn it over to the closer, and he gets all the glory because he got three outs in the ninth inning on a clean slate. And, you know, my dad, God bless him, I could come in and pitch 12 games in a row and do my job and call home every day, and he wouldn't say anything about baseball. The 13th game, I'd go out there, give up a homer or something and lose the game, call home, and the next day, what the hell happened last night? And the exact same thing with, you know, I go out there and do my job every day for umpteen days in a row, and then I screw up the game, we lose, and now every reporter wants to talk to me. Well, they don't want to talk to me the last 12, 13 games. So it's kind of, I always looked at it as that unsung hero. And the only stat I ever cared about was inherited runners scored. I didn't get paid for wins. I didn't get paid for saves. Inherited runners that didn't score was my only stat that I cared about.
Yeah, that's good. You know, when they made the universal DH, I thought, wow, you know, the times for those guys, you know, when you guys had to hit, I mean, those guys that could give you those two innings, because yeah, maybe you're down by five, those guys could give you those two third innings. They were hugely important, you know, to keep you in a game, to give you a chance to come back in a game. And now, I mean, I don't even know if those guys even exist anymore. I don't even know if guys actually outside of the closer, if anybody has a defined role. And you guys, I remember, you know, I'll talking to my pitching staffs in spring trainings, a lot of them, they all want to know what the role was going to be, you know. And of course, when I first started managing, I remember in the minor leagues, a pitcher came to me one time. He said, "What's my role?" I said, "To get out the guy I'm bringing you in the face. That's your role."
It's funny you say that. Huh? Because it's funny that you bring that up, because that was the thing that I thought was very important. That you know your role, you accept your role, and you try to be the best you can at it. And Bobby V was awesome. He would go around to every guy the first day during batting practice, opening day, and tell you your role. He would always tell me, "You're my guy up or down by three after the sixth, or in the sixth or on, you'll never pitch before the fifth." And, you know, to me, that's when you hear, in my personal opinion, when you hear a team say, "Hey, we're there's no set closer, it's a bullpen by committee." To me, that's a kiss of death, because from the first inning to the ninth, every time that phone rings, everybody's going, "Oh, you know, is it me? Is it me?" But and that's why I joked around with you guys. I thought closing was the easiest job in the bullpen. The game dictates whether you're going to pitch or not, and you don't get overly abused with the warming up and sitting down, the dry humps and stuff. Right. So I just thought, you know, having your role and knowing your role is key to a successful bullpen.
Yeah. Well, John, I want to turn it over to you. I know you got some questions for these two guys.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much, Terry. Guys, what a pleasure it is to be here with you. As I mentioned, you were both part of Mets teams that made it to the World Series. Roger, you were instrumental part of that 86 World Championship team. And Turk, of course, key member of the 2000 nationally champion New York Mets. Can you describe those seasons and what it meant to make it to the World Series in New York as a member of the Mets?
Go ahead, Roger.
Well, you have to remember, 86 was my second year in the big leagues. And I guess I didn't understand the enormity of what was happening. Yeah, I knew that we were in the playoffs against Houston, beat Houston in the playoffs, and we go in the World Series against Boston. But you really don't understand what it was really all about. I was just trying to stay in the big leagues. My second year, especially my first year, after every bad game or game that I didn't perform very well, I thought I was going to get sent down. And so, you know, move on to 86 when we won 108 games regular season and counting the playoffs and World Series, 116 overall. I probably – the memory that I have are the relationships that I had with the other players, the people that I had an opportunity to play with, guys – Gary Carter goes in the Hall of Fame. I got to play with Keith Hernandez. I got to play with Ray Knight. I got to play with Mookie Wilson, Daryl Strawberry. And the 86 team, if you remember, we had basically, I think, four or five platoons. We had a platoon at second base with Tim Tuffel and Wally Backman. We had a platoon at third base with Howard Johnson and Ray Knight. Had a platoon in center field with Mookie and Lenny. And we had a platoon in the bullpen with Jesse and I as co-closers. So, you know, and Kevin Mitchell was the fifth infielder and the fourth outfielder. And so, you know, you look at these guys' careers, you know, Kevin Mitchell goes on, I think he was close to winning the Triple Crown and with San Diego or San Francisco. And all these guys that were, I guess, platoon guys, there was never an I, me. It was always about a W at the end of the night. And that's the most memorable part of 86. The guys that I got to play with, the friendships that have lasted 40 years, and the opportunity to be on a world championship team, be one of 25 guys standing at the end of the year that you can say that you won a world championship. And that's the special part about it.
Turk?
I kind of piggyback that a little bit into the fact that there was no real I, me in our team, and that, you know, we had the superstar player Bob Piazza, but nobody cared who got credit for the win that night or who was the hero of the night as long as we won the game. That was the most important thing. And we kind of policed ourselves in the clubhouse when, you know, somebody was slacking or whatever. Some guys would get on one guy or all that kind of stuff. But as far as going into the World Series, a lot of people would ask me, reporters, you know, isn't this great? It's what you work for. Yeah, it's what you work for. But for me, I lived my dream every day putting a big league uniform on. Yeah. This was icing on the cake, getting to the World Series, because, you know, that's the goal every team has in spring training. But playing in the Subway Series took it to a whole nother level. I mean, the buzz in the city was, it's incredible. And personally, the only time I really got to relax during the World Series was when the game started. There was just anybody. I mean, it was just a parade of celebrities coming through the clubhouse. And, you know, it was great meeting all these people. But once you were on the field, the game started, like, nobody could bother you anymore. You could just sit and relax and focus on the game. But, you know, yeah, it sucked that we lost and everybody still talks about game one and Timo not running out, the home run or double by Zeal, and, you know, McCookie Rojas sending Pratt home. There's so many different things. Everybody can play Monday morning quarterback with pretty much every game. But it was just really unbelievably cool feeling to be part of a Subway Series in a city like New York. I mean, and we talked earlier about the baseball gods, and my thing was, you know, I grew up a Red Sox fan, and I don't like big cities. I'm just a country boy, and I never wanted to play in New York because I'm a Red Sox fan. I didn't like the Yankees, and I just don't like big cities. So I always said, I never want to play in New York. Well, baseball gods bit me in the ass, and I get traded to the Mets. And best thing that ever happened in my career. By far the best.
Awesome. Thing. Awesome. And both of you had the opportunity a couple years ago to participate in the old timers game, the first one at Citi Field. How was that experience for both of you?
Oh, it was nice to see a lot of guys I hadn't seen in a while. and to meet some of the guys from the later teams with the Mets, and get to see guys from the 69 team. And I thought it was fantastic. I thought the Mets did a fantastic job. I thought Jay Horwich did a fantastic job lining up everybody to get there, and all the things that were involved with having that special day. And the fans were terrific. TC, I think you were the winning manager too.
I was.
I remember Mazzilli. I mean, he took a monster swing on his first at bat, and I don't know if he pulled a oblique or whatever. And TC says, "Can anybody hit?" And nobody raised their hand. And he says, "Roger, you can hit." Yeah, I'll go up there. So he sends me up to face Pedro Martinez, right? So I hit a little ground ball to shortstop that, Rafael Santana, back in the day, he would have gobbled it up. But, with his age and everything, he can barely bend over. He'll fall. And so I got a knock off Pedro.
Nice. For me, it was a blast meeting players that I grew up watching and players that I watched from the other side or something like that and didn't get to play with. That to me was kind of cool that they even knew who I was, that I never got to meet them, but yeah, it was pretty cool. And just the whole, like Roger said, choreographing all that stuff and putting everybody together at that one point in time was amazing. The stuff they had to do to pull that off. And it was, I hope they keep doing it.
Yeah. It was great for the fans and for someone who's followed the team as I have since the 60s. It was great to see Steve Cohen organize that. And I hope it is a tradition that continues. I wanted to touch upon both of your individual personalities, because you both remain in Mets lore for different reasons. And I'm going to start with Roger. Roger, you were a prankster for sure. You were the master of the hot foot, where you use bubble gum, wrap it around a book of matches, around a cigarette, get it to somebody unsuspecting, light up the cigarette, and before you know it, chaos ensues. I wanted to ask you how you came up with the prank. And who was your favorite target to give a hot foot to when you were with the Mets?
Well, all the credit should go to Howard Johnson. And Howard Johnson came over from the Detroit Tigers. And I don't know if it was, back then, there was one game on a week, and it was Saturday. And before the Saturday game of the week, I think it was Mel Allen had a half-hour show. And there was a part of the show talked about the hot foot, and it was the Detroit Tigers. And so I asked Howard about it, and he goes, "Yeah, I know how to do it." And so he showed me, how the Detroit Tigers, and I guess they weren't the only one back in the day that did it. And so I kind of perfected a little bit, as opposed to bubble gum. And if you remember, the camera well was right next to the dugout at Shea. And so they would have this tape. It was called gaffer's tape. And so I started playing with the gaffer's tape. And the cameraman, I said, "Hey, can I have this roll of gaffer's tape?" He said, "Sure." So I started playing with that, because the gum, obviously, you had to get a different consistency. It couldn't be too hard. It couldn't be too sugary. On hot days, it would melt, and the hot foot would fall off somebody's shoe. And so I started using gaffer's tape. And it became a somewhat of a process. First off, I had to figure out that you couldn't wrap the matches around the cigarette too tight, because then it would choke it off, and the air would stop it from lighting up the matches. And it was a whole process that NASA would be proud of. And so my favorite guy is Bill Robinson, because Bill Robinson was the first base coach, and he was he never liked to be called a hitting coach. He liked to be called a hitting instructor. And so, he was very easygoing, a lot of fun to be around, as all of our coaches and everybody were, but it was, you know, first base coach, I mean, really, what's the responsibility down there? And you know, you stand down there and you take the gloves and tell them how many outs there are. And so he became a favorite target. And I remember one time in Cincinnati, we were playing the Reds at Riverfront Stadium, and I put one on Bill in the dugout. And he runs out to first base, and Pete Rose, who was the manager player at the time, he saw what was happening. And all the cameras, we notified the camera guys, and Bill Webb, who was the producer, and they're all on board. And lo and behold, Pete Rose takes his whole team down to where Bill Robinson is at first base coaching, because the dugouts were so close at Riverfront. And so this thing goes off, and it looked like a rocket launch. And it was a night game, but it was like in the middle of an at bat, and so this thing goes off, and Bill finally figures out. And the next day, Bill Robinson called me when I got to the clubhouse. He called me and said, "Hey, Roger, I want to show you something." So he goes, "It's out on the field," and what Bill had done was taken my gamer spikes, and had put lighter fluid on them and burned them. So, the old saying is payback is.
Yep.
And so, Bill was my favorite, and that's how that got started.
Yeah.
Howard Johnson deserves all the credit for that one.
Yeah, there was a tutorial that appeared in the '86 Mets documentary of you and Howard, like teaching people how to give a proper hot.
Yeah, I don't think that'd go over big right now.
No. It's kind of a different environment, but that was very cool back in the day.
I don't think that tutorial would work in today's social media.
Not today. Not today. You gotta be careful on it, everything. Did that role of a prankster and did that help land the role of being the second spitter on Seinfeld?
No, I don't think so. I think, and a caveat to that was, I remember David Johnson pulled me aside. He said, "Roger, understand this. There's a time and place." Okay. And so I had to make sure it was the right time and the right place. And, you know, we had won a few games in a row, and it was early in the game, and I had no responsibilities. But the part about the Seinfeld episode was, I think the person that they really wanted was Straw to do that. And I think at the time Straw was not able to get across state lines for whatever reason. And so they asked me to do it. Keith calls me up and says, "Hey, Raj, can you fly out to California to do this show?" And I'd never heard of the show. I mean, it was the second season, and, you know, it was early in the Seinfeld episodes. And so I went out there, and, you know, I'll remember this part was that after about 15 takes of me doing the Artie Johnson behind the bushes and spitting, at one point, I think I told the director or whatever, saying, "Hey, listen, I'm out of spit. You know, I can't, I got no more saliva left." And so he says, "Well, just act like you're spitting." So, you know, I guess you could call me an actor because of that.
Yeah, do a lot in post-production, the magic loogie. But that was very entertaining. So very memorable episode. And Turk, of course, you and your personality and some of the quirks and superstitions have lived on in Mets lore and baseball history. Some of them are, you know, leaping over the foul line in and out of the dugout, brushing your teeth in between innings. Four pieces of black licorice before every inning, the shells around your neck, the number 99. And I believe you also signed a contract at one time that had all nines in it. Yeah. So talk to us about those superstitions. When did they start, and how did they go over with your teammates? And of course the fans loved them.
Well, it was just part of your routine. This is basically how it all evolves. I mean, we're creatures of habit. Through success and failure, we tend to do things. Back in high school, I went out, pitched an inning, gave up a run, you know, thinking, what the heck did I do differently? I remember stepping on that dang foul line before I went out to take the mound that day. So from then on there, I always jumped over the foul line. And it got a little more pronounced over the years. Pointed to the center fielder to make sure he was ready, because in high school, my teammate Jimmy Duquette, which I'm sure you guys all know, He was in center field, and I like to work really quick. Came in, pitched the inning, and came in the dugout afterwards. And he said, "Dude, you got to make sure I'm ready. You threw a pitch or two, and I wasn't even looking yet." Now, why he wasn't looking towards home is beyond me. But so since then, I always, "Hey, Duke, are you ready? Can we play now?" And I go to college, and I never chew tobacco or anything like that. And these guys played this game where they'd spit on your shoes, and if they hit your shoelace, they got to, you know, hit you in the chest and wipe it off. It's this little college game that they played. And I wanted to play the game too. So I figured, well, I like black licorice. It looks like a chew. It looks cool. And so I started chewing black licorice. And well, I don't know. I mean, I think four or five pieces was about all I could fit in my mouth. So that's how that evolved. And I get drafted and I go play rookie ball. Had a bad taste in my mouth. And I asked the bat boy if he could run up and get my toothbrush so I could brush my teeth. Went out, struck out the side. So next thing you know, and I mean, I'm here to tell you too, it was pretty bizarre. But my teammates, I think at first were like, "What's this guy doing?" But once they got to know me and know my competitive nature, that I mean, I wasn't the most talented guy, but I would do whatever it took to win, and almost to a point where I was too competitive at times. So Chicago, I'm pitching, and I was more focused on facing those big name players, you know, like McGuire, Bonds at the time, or Tony Gwynn. And then some guy that comes up that's a rookie or just got called up to big leagues, you know, "Yeah, who's this guy?" Just throw one in there. Boom. I think it was some little Cabrera. He ended up being their shortstop for a long time with the Expos. He hit a dinger off me. And I remember being so mad that I grabbed that rosin bag and just fired it down and just screamed at myself internally to stay focused, stay aggressive. And from then on, at the start of every inning, I'd grab that rosin bag and just chuck it as hard as I could. And for some reason,
and the crowd would pop when you did that.
Yeah,
too.
For some reason, they just loved it when I did that. And there was times where I only did it to start the inning. And there was times whenever I got two strikes, I'd always grab the rosin bag and I would pat it on the back of my wrist, and then I would slowly bring my hand down, because then when I threw the ball, it would make a poof and it could distract the hitter. And so I didn't, when I grabbed the rosin bag, everyone would start, "Ah," and then I would just set it down and they'd be like, "Oh, what the, that's not what I do." So, yeah, I mean, I'll be the first to tell you, it was really off the wall kind of stuff, but, it's just, we do stupid things. There's success and failure. It's just the way, the nature of the beast.
What about the next?
I want to hear about the contract.
Yeah, the contract. Oh.
So I get traded to the Cubs or to the Mets, and I always had 13. And I had, I don't know, maybe a month or two or 3 months more in the big leagues than Alfonso. And Alfonso had 13 and wouldn't give me 13. So I remember Jay Horowitz calling me, and I said, "Hey, Alfonso, give me 13. He said, "No, he wouldn't do it." So I said, "Well, what'd they give me, Jay?" I think he said number 10. And I said, 10? And now, trust me, I have no clue. I've never had any other number. And he goes, "What number do you want?" And I had no idea. I don't even know why number 99 popped in my head. Not a clue. But I just said, "How about 99? And Jay goes, "That's pretty messed up, but I like it. You got it." So then it was, you know, everybody thought I had this infatuation with nines. And when the contract time came, my agent thought it'd be great to, instead of $10 million, $999,099. And Duke used to say, "I'm going to give you a penny just to make it 10, all right?" But the necklace, it's just, I don't know. I was with the Cubs and started being fortunate enough to get different animals when I was hunting. And it was just my tribute to the animals to put a piece of it on the necklace. And, you know, I had turkey spurs, deer antlers, mountain lion claws, bear claws. And, I don't know, some of the Latin guys I play with say, "Dude, Poppy, that scares my friends." So I guess it worked as a little bit of intimidation factor.
Didn't you send one to Taiwan Walker too? When he wore number 99 for the Phillies a couple years ago.
Yeah. That was Jay's doing. He's like, "Yeah, could you send Taiwan, make a necklace for Taiwan?" I said, "Taiwan, God bless the guy." He didn't even know who the hell I was. No clue. And, you know, it is what it is, but, I don't believe he ever wore it. He probably doesn't have it anymore, but, Jay just thought it was a good PR thing to do.
Wow. Jay's a great guy. All right, TC, back to you.
Well, obviously you can see why one of the things these guys bring is a personality to the club, and that's why they're loved by, you know, the fans love them, but their teammates love them. I mean, you know, and both of them, I've known both of them for a long time, and I will tell you, the competitiveness of when they got on the mound, you know, they did their job. And just like Dirk said earlier, you know, hey, look, you know, he might get somebody's attention, that first guy in the batter's box, get their attention. Just to let them know that, hey, it's on now. It's a challenge. And I saw Roger pitching the minor leagues. And I'll tell you a little story. I told him the other day. But when I was managing in San Antonio for the Dodgers in AA, and Sandy Koufax was roving through the minor leagues at that particular time. So he's in San Antonio, and Roger's pitching he's pitching for the Jackson Mets, and starts the game against us. When the game was over, Sandy Koufax came in, and Dave Wallace was my pitching coach at the time. He said, that kid yet on the Mets, that Roger McDowell, he's got the best pitching mechanics I have ever seen, ever. And I thought, what a compliment. And of course, 2 years later, you know, he's pitching in the big leagues. And, you know, matter of fact, to be honest, when I first saw Roger in the bullpen for years, I thought, God, why don't they start this guy? Koufax said, this guy's got the best mechanics he's ever seen. So, I mean, and then I remember facing Turk all the time. And I'll tell you, when he's on the other team, I'm going to tell you, the guys in the dugout used to mumble about him because he, you know, he pitched all the time. I mean, we saw him, you'd go into a series and you look out and shit, he's warming up again. It's like he never had a day off. So they bring great personalities to the club, and that's why they're fun. And, you know, we spent some time last week at that golf tournament, and we couldn't stop telling a funny story. It was just one after another when we were done playing. And I thought, you know, I got to have these two guys on this show because they bring a lot of fun, a lot of personalities. And, you know, if you think, Raj, if you think Turk intimidated him then, you got to take a picture of what's behind him and send that out to those other.
I'm telling you. I'm looking for the boogers.
Let's put it that way. I'm always ready, right?
I can see that. I can see that. So, John, I know you got some questions from the fans for these guys.
Oh, yeah, we do. Several have come in, and we've picked a few of them here. First one is for Roger. It comes from Michael Torres on our X account. He wants to know, what kind of residual checks do you get from that Seinfeld appearance?
Is it the same Michael Torres that pitched for us? I just saw Mike Torres at Doc's number 16 retirement ceremony, and what a great pleasure to see him again. Anyway, he was one of the older pitchers also, you know, along with the guys I mentioned, Dick Tidrow and those guys. I get $13.52 every time that episode is aired. So
okay. You
know, now that it's in syndication worldwide, I might get one every month. I mean, every 6 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks, I'll probably get
$10.99 for that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I still have to pay my Screen Actors Guild union dues. And I come out losing money. But it was obviously, it was a great part of TV history. And I'm very, very proud to have been a part of it.
We have actually, this is for all of you. No, and it's not a fan question, but we've talked about superstitions with Turk and his idiosyncrasies and all the little things that he did. And we also talked about the baseball gods a little bit. And I think everyone on this panel right now kind of believes that there's something to that. And the reason I bring that up is that this past Friday in New York, the Mets, Jose Iglesias, who is a recent acquisition, they brought him up from the minor leagues. He wrote a song in the offseason called OMG, Oh My God. He used it as his walk-up song. He started performing, getting hits. Before you know it, after every Mets home run, OMG is playing on the loudspeaker, and now after every Mets victory. The song officially came out with a music video last week. It's taken off. And after the City Connect game on Friday against the Astros, City Field turned into a nightclub because I think for the first time ever in Major League Baseball history, an active player performed a mini concert in front of the stadium in his uniform, and that was Iglesias with OMG. We have a clip of that because what's gone on since then is that the Mets lost two in a row, and because, as we'll see in this video, the team celebrated. It seems like they might have pissed off the baseball gods, but let's check out that video now, and then we'll discuss it.
New York City! Let's keep the party going!
And there you go. I love the team camaraderie and the way everyone's embraced each other. What do you guys think of – did it piss off the baseball gods? Or could it
happen? I know one thing. I believe there are such things as baseball gods. And the one thing you don't want to do is ever embarrass the other team because they're going to come back to get you. And I thought it was great. First of all, I know Jose. I was with him last year when I was doing consulting stuff with the Marlins. He's a great guy. He's got a tremendous story of how he came to the United States and what he went through to get to become a big league player. So he's a wonderful guy. But yeah, I am sure the Astros didn't think it was that something to celebrate that big. I can tell you.
I wish I knew a little better Spanish so I could know all the words for one. And I'm disappointed there's no backup dancers dancing. Some women there.
Were some in the beginning. There were a few dancers out there before it started, yes.
Yeah, I think there are – obviously, we've been in the game a long time. You know, when you start getting a little bit full of yourself and you start thinking that things are on a roll, that there's baseball gods that have a way of humbling that part of you going forward. You know – 86, we had a video. I forget what the name of it was, but
Let's Go Mets.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah. And we did it. And the one thing that, you know, looking back, is like, you better be able to back it up. When you go out there, you better be able to back it up. And so, you know, obviously times have changed. You know, the game has changed. The social media, everything's changed. The players have changed. And, you know, if they want to have fun and enjoy it, so be it. As long as it doesn't take away from the performance on the field. And at the end of the day, I think that's what baseball fans and, in particular, New York Met fans, they want. They want the performance on the field. And whatever you do after that is a bonus as long as you win. You need to win. You need to win.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they do all these in-mic stuff in the games. The fans want to be basically right there on the field with the players. And, you know, if guys were playing bad then, or the teams were playing bad, they wouldn't want any of that stuff. So
I remember before Keith Hernandez came to the Mets and he was with the Cardinals and the Mets, he was like 82, 83 maybe. But it was right before he came to the Mets, and you know, there's, you know, every year you have a new slogan, And I think the new slogan was, here's, you know, the future of baseball, you know. And, you know, you had Strawberry coming up through the minor leagues. You had Gooden coming up through the minor leagues. And I remember Keith saying that when he was with the Cardinals and they came in and seen that slogan, they're going, wait a minute, these guys lose 100 games a year. What are they talking about, you know? So it's
– I got to grab a phone charger. Definitely something that
you got to change. He's going to get a gun.
Oh, wow. It could have been through the magic is back era, whatever, the magic is back or whatever they use back in the day. But, yeah, I love the way the song and the team has come together. And Iglesias, I think Terry had a lot to do with that. I mean, he brought this energy and he brought this infectious personality, and then he brings the song into the mix, and they've loved it. But, yeah, I love to see the team gel the way they have. I mean, that camaraderie is so important. But once again, you know, you don't want to piss off the other team or the baseball gods. And
You know, and it is great to see the energy. And the fans bought into it. They loved it. And that's what it's about. But because he is, you know, I'm telling you, this guy is a fine human being. And, you know, so I'm glad they're having fun. And you know what? And it's going to lead, because the more you win, the more fun you have. And I think it's a great start. So.
Yeah, they're turning Citi Field on Friday nights into some type of special with dancing and DJs and the action on the field and the Citi Connect uniform. So it's really a great, pleasant experience for the fans to be out there. That's all I got, TC. I mean, this has been a pleasure for me to just hang out with these two gentlemen, because, you know, growing up and seeing them both play, being at all those World Series games that were referenced, it was really truly an honor for me to be in front of both of them.
Well, it's certainly a pleasure. Thanks, guys, again, for coming on. And it's so fun. It's so fun to sit and talk baseball. It's so fun to sit and talk about, you know, even though it would say they can say anything, but, you know, you talk about the way the game used to be played and some of the things that went on. And, you know, that's what, you know, still is fun for us. You know, we have great memories and great friends, and you two are certainly a huge part of that. So thanks again for being on the show.
Well, thank you.
My pleasure too. I mean, you can't put a price on the camaraderie that being a baseball player in the big leagues has. And those are the things I miss the most.
Well, thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. To the all-time best relievers and memorable characters in Mets history, Roger McDowell and Turk Wendell. Terry, that was fun.
Yeah, that was fun. They're fun guys, tremendous personalities, both of them. You know, John, I'll tell you a real quick story. I hired Roger to his first pitching coach's job in the minor league, and, you know, I came in with this, just like we talked about in the interview, with this personality of, like, being a prankster and kind of a character. I have never been more impressed with a guy who was so organized, had a great plan, game plan. There was his first coaching job. When the game was over, he stayed on the field and fixed the pitcher's mound by himself. He didn't even let the ground crew do it. I mean, he was outstanding. 3 years later, he's the pitching coach for 10 years with the Atlanta Braves. So he was really, really an exceptional guy.
Yeah, so you
and Turk, you gave him so fun. He's just so fun. He's, you know, no matter what he does, he makes you laugh.
Yeah, he's definitely a character to this day. But I wasn't aware that you gave Roger his first coaching job after his playing days were over. And of course, he had that great long career.
Yeah, he was, I'm telling you, and a great coach, really, really good coach.
Yeah. Well, Terry, time now for the Tunnel to Towers Amazing Hero of the Week. And born on America's darkest day of 9/11, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation has been helping America's heroes ever since. This week, Tunnel to Towers will announce 35 mortgage payoffs. That's part of the goal, to pay off 200 mortgages this year for fallen first responders and Gold Star families. They will deliver 40 specially adapted smart homes for catastrophically wounded military members and first responders. And they're going to provide housing for more than 3,000 veterans this year. Join Tunnel to Towers on its mission to do good in their honor by joining me in donating $11 a month at t2t.org. That's T, the number 2T.org. Never forget 9/11 or the sacrifices of this country's heroes and their families. And on this week's segment, we honor the amazing hero of the week, former Olympic hero and former WWE World Heavyweight Champion and member of their Hall of Fame, Kurt Angle. Let's go to that right now.
My name is Kurt Angle, and I represented the United States in the Olympics in 1996 and won a gold medal. Then I parlayed that into a pro wrestling career.
Angle slam connected!
And I wrestled for the WWE and Impact Wrestling for 20 years.
Tunnel to Towers Foundation made a promise we're going to help every single one of them.
I saw a commercial a few years ago for Tunnel to Towers, and it piqued my interest.
By giving $11 a month, you're joining us on our mission to do good.
I was like, wow, this is really cool what they're doing for families of our fallen heroes. And for the first responders and the veterans, I thought, this is really cool. I want to be a part of it. My dad served in the Army for 30 years. He was in the reserves, I believe, for 20 of that. He was a hard worker. He was a construction worker. And he ended up being a master drill sergeant in the Army. We didn't have a lot of money, but he made sure we had what we needed. And he set a great example for all of us. And he taught me a lot of stuff about wrestling and about life. My dad died in a construction accident my freshman year in high school. When he died, we didn't have any income coming in. And we ended up being forced to move out of our house. And I remember how I felt. I was devastated. And so I understand what these families are going through. And to have an organization like Tunnel to Towers come in and pick you up and, carry you and give you a home to live in, I think that's just amazing. I think it gives them a sense of security. It lets them know that there's one thing that nobody can ever take away from them, and that's their home.
It changed my life. It changed my son's life. For me not to have to worry about things that were such a burden.
The Tunnel to Towers Foundation is paying off the mortgages for Gold Star families with young children. I'd like to ask you to donate $11 a month to support these efforts by going to T2T.org or calling 1-844-BRAVEST.
Another great week here, and what great things they do each and every week. And there seems to be more and more high-profile personalities getting involved with the organization, which is great to see.
Well, they deserve everything they're getting because, if you research it at all, it breaks your heart to think that people are going through what they're going through and, with their loved ones helping us live a better life. It's certainly a charity or a foundation worth donating to.
Yes, indeed. And of course, this week, the 4th of July week is always a very important one for Tunnel to Towers, as it is for America. And Terry, any major 4th of July plans down in Florida for you?
No, not too many. I'm not a big fireworks guy, so it'd probably just be a cookout and a salute to everybody that, in this great country.
Absolutely. Same here. Well, we appreciate it, Terry. Another week in the books. I know you'll be on location next week, and so we'll be recording and taping another show with another special guest that we will announce on social media. We're working on a few of them right now, but each and every week we're bringing the fans some real great legends and personalities of this great organization. And Terry, we want to thank you again for doing the show each and every week. It's always a pleasure to be with you. You could follow Terry on social media, Instagram and X, simply at @TerryCollins_10. You could follow me on those same platforms, simply at John Arezzi. And make sure you subscribe now to the Terry Collins Show wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And on YouTube, and please subscribe to us there as well. Until next time, this is John Arezzi for Terry Collins. Have a great July 4th week, everyone.